What I'd like to talk about, as mentioned in the introduction, is kind of broadly the theme of this book called The Here and Now Habit, How Mindfulness Can Help You Break Unhealthy Habits Once and For All. I don't know, maybe that's not something that you'd have to deal with. Anyone have any habits? So I want to talk about this and just kind of make cover some general themes of this. I think my tendency is to try to say everything, so I'm going to consciously avoid that, you know, do a book in 40 minutes. It's like when they do Shakespeare in, like, what, you know, all of Shakespeare in an hour or something. You know? So we won't try and do that. At least that's my intention. So just to begin, I became interested in this theme of mindfulness and habits a few years ago. And I've been practicing meditation for maybe over 25, maybe 30 years now. But it became clearer and clearer to me that much of the stress and the suffering we experience in life, certainly that I experienced in life, didn't so much come from one-time things, you know, something that happened. I mean, sometimes it is. Sometimes a big thing happens, it's painful, we've got to deal with it. But most often, it came from, or comes from, behaviors and patterns of thinking that we repeat over and over and don't seem able to change. Do you have any of those? Anyone like to just toss out a habit that feels like salient, relevant to you, that one that you're dealing with? Just a few. Any thoughts? What's that? I'm such an idiot. Being hard on yourself, judgmental.
Worry,
a big one. Anyone else worry? Any worriers here? Ruminating. Yeah, absolutely. Ruminating, thinking about the past. Trying to create a better past, right? Yeah. One or two more? Any more? Unloved. So that thinking yourself. Yeah. Anyone have any to do with devices? Traffic. Chocolate.
Shopping online.
Yeah, some great ones. Thinking things you don't want to think, or saying them?
You want to name.
Okay. Lovely. Thank you for sharing those. Yeah, so just name a few of the things, and a number of these are kind of included in what you've said, what you've shared. But, you know, there's the obvious ones of eating and drinking, you know, in unhealthy ways or unmindfully, maybe for some smoking, even things like biting our nails, you know, just kind of little irritations almost, but there are all ways in which we're not really present for our experience. We're not here now. Others maybe, you know, don't come so obviously to mind, but nonetheless very much within this kind of ballpark. One would be driving, you know, impatiently, maybe even aggressively. Anyone find, you know, you're on the freeway and, you know, there's all these people bothering you, you know, that too many people, how dare they come out and interfere with your empty road or whatever. It might be things like, you know, do you ever talk about others in a way, you know, when they're not present, in a way that's not really kind? You know, maybe when you're with a particular person, oh, so-and-so, you know, they're always doing this. You know, maybe getting into angry confrontations with a work person at work, a colleague at work, or somebody, a family member. And we kind of repeat those patterns, you know, it's like we're pushing each other's buttons. Or, as I said, you know, checking email, spending... Did anyone here feel like you spend too much time online? Social media, checking the internet. Yeah, it's a very, very common one, much more so, I think, than even a few years ago. Anyone procrastinate? Okay, we've got a lot of hands up on that one. You know, getting impatient in traffic. One that's a really, really, a common one, and one that I found myself working with a lot, and maybe I'll talk some about this evening, is getting caught up in stressful and anxious states, you know, getting caught up in those stories in our mind that, you know, things are going to go bad unless, you know, if I don't do all of these things, and there's too many of those things to do. Maybe it's judging yourself. You know, if you're thinking anything that comes up, you're kind of, oh, there I go again, or, I'm not good enough, or I'm not worthy, or maybe judging others, being unkind to others. There's a whole lot more that I haven't mentioned, but these just to kind of cover a number of areas at least. When we do any of these on a regular basis, it's likely that they've become habits. And once they've become habitual, they become harder to change. And I'm going to talk about that, why that's the case. And we can get locked in patterns that we'd like to change, but we keep repeating. We keep repeating the behavior, or we keep repeating the thought pattern. And this is why mindfulness is so important. And so for me, this theme of bringing mindfulness to habits, to habit patterns, is a really important way of exploring the Buddha's teachings of how do we let go of clinging. Because when we're caught up in habits, it's a form of clinging. You know, it may be a clinging in the craving kind of way, or a more of an aversion kind of way, or it may be more a distraction, kind of checking out kind of way. But it's all the ways in which we create suffering for ourselves. And I think that understanding habits and how they form and why they can be so difficult to change is really a key to finding freedom from suffering. I mean, basically the goal, the objective of the Buddha's path to freedom. And doing that through awareness, through mindfulness of our present moment's experience. So what I want to share are some thoughts this evening about the beginning with really how much of our suffering comes from behaviors that we repeat habitually. So and those behaviors are quite different than things that are, you know, more intentional, you know, which we do and say, oh, I want to do this. It might be a harmful thing, but it's different in nature than when we do it habitually for reasons I'll talk about in a minute. Also, understanding how habits work and why they can be so hard to change, and also how mindfulness can help us in changing habits, this can allow us to live more freely. It can allow us to find freedom from suffering in our lives, here and now in our very lives. So I'll talk about some of the ways in which mindfulness can help us change unhealthy habit patterns and live more freely. And I'll finish up with some reflections, perhaps from my own experience, and an invitation to you to explore as you go from here back into your daily life, if there is anything that it would serve you to give attention to in the ways that we're discussing this evening. Maybe begin with just at the beginning of a story of one of the ways that I became really interested in this area of mindfulness and habits. And that was a little bit before I started writing this book. I found myself caught up in a period of really intense stress and worry and anxiety. Anyone ever been there? You know, some of the characteristics of this were, you know, the story that was in my mind was I had too much to do. And, you know, there was some objective truth in that. You know, I tended to take on, oh, yeah, I'll say yes to this 6 months down the line or 3 months down the line. Oh, sure, I'll do that. And I'll do that too. And not very wisely, because when those days came along, oh, my God, I've got all these things to do. So there was some objective basis to it. But more than the objective basis was the kind of being hooked into this story in my mind of like, I've got too much to do. And how it manifests, and this will be familiar, I know, to many of you, is, you know, I'd be in this state a lot of the time. It's almost like, I've got to get through this because, you know, I've got to get this done, and then I've got to move on to something else and get this done, and kind of a sense of contraction and tightness and tension and stress. And it gets very difficult, particularly around 3 or 4 in the morning. You know, I'd find myself, because my mind was in such a kind of stressful, anxious place, I'd very easily wake up in the night and with all these thoughts, oh my God, I've got all these things to do. How am I going to ever do them? And the story in my mind was that I wasn't going to be able to do them all. I'd fail. I'd let myself down. I'd let other people down. And, you know, kind of, it tended almost to get into the catastrophizing. You know, one bad thing would lead to another. You know, I wouldn't be able to earn a living. My partner would leave me. And in the end, you know, kind of the scenario I have is that you're lying naked in a ditch, hungry, alone, dying, you know, because the mind keeps creating these scenarios, you know, one worse than the other. And, you know, although I joke about it now, at the time it was very, very intense. It was almost my life was like, it's not working for me. You know, I've got all these things to do, but I'm failing. You know, I'm failing at my, you know, what I've committed to and my life as I defined it and all of this. And then, of course, the more there was this anxious thinking, the more difficult it was to get to sleep. You know, so I'd be, you know, up for hours, you know, kind of, I really want to get to sleep. I try really hard to get to sleep. And the more you try, of course, the harder it is to get to sleep. And then there's all the thoughts about, oh, I'm going to be so tired tomorrow. I'm not going to be able to do anything else. It just kind of gets into this kind of really kind of vicious cycle thing. And it got really difficult for me. It was a hard time for a while. But fortunately, I mean, I've been practicing mindfulness for at least a couple of decades. And I said to myself, I really need to pay attention to this. I really need to put the spotlight on this, because this isn't what the Buddha was talking about, freedom from suffering, because this was suffering, you know. This was, something wasn't working, you know, something needed more attention. And just to, I mean, I'll pause this story here, maybe talk a little bit more about some details about it later. But one thing was really became clear to me was that this was, in fact, a habit pattern that I had become identified with. This story of too busy, not going to be able to do everything, was something that I had bought into, that something I believed to be true that wasn't objectively true. I mean, at other times in my life when hadn't been buying into the story, I'd been able to do lots of things, you know, juggle lots of things and lots of demands and stuff. But at this time, for different reasons, I was kind of caught up in the story. It's almost like when you get caught up in this way, you get into the fight or flight mode, and there's a kind of tunnel vision. If you notice this, it seems like you've just got to solve this problem. And everything else in life almost fades into the background. You lose connection with joy because you're just so focused on, I've got to find a solution to this. I've got to find a way out of this. So the habit, the first important thing was to recognize this was really a pattern of thinking. There's a nice story of a Zen monk in a cave. And he painted a painting of a tiger on the wall of the cave. And every time he looked at the tiger, he'd get terrified, you know. And this is an image, I think, of when you get into this state, you know, like we've painted the picture ourselves, but then every time we look at it, we get freaked out. We go, oh my God, it's so scary, you know. And we forget that we're the ones that have done the drawing, done the painting. And that's a helpful thing for me to just see, like, oh, I've actually painted that picture. So a couple of things just to say for now about this experience. I mean, two things were really critical to finding a way out of this kind of syndrome, this stress anxiety state. The first was to see the story as a story. To see the thoughts as thoughts rather than as true, and just to notice, and you know, oh, there's an anxious thought, rather than believing the story, rather than seeing the tiger and saying, oh my God, I'm so scared, I've got to run, seeing the tiger and say, oh, there's the painting of the tiger that I did. Knowing that I've painted the tiger myself. Oh yeah, that's that scary painting. No, that's the anxious thought. That's the stressful thought. That was the first thing, working wisely with the thinking patterns. And the other key piece for me was being willing to stay with the direct experience, to ride the waves of the bodily feelings and the emotions. Because if you can stay with those, you know, and then the story comes up, but you kind of bow to the story and come back, then all of these bodily sensations, all of these emotions are impermanent. They come, they last for a while. And if you can find the resilience or the ability to be with and stay with the experience, then everything will go after a while. Emotions last for a finite period of time. We perpetuate them when we resist them or believe them to be true, or we, you know, we don't open to them, we can kind of keep them going. What Jung said, I think, what we resist persists. What we resist persists. What we try and push away actually doesn't go away. In fact, I don't think there's any such place as away, is there? Away is a kind of a concept, isn't it? And Eckhart Tolle says, what we accept, what you accept, you go beyond. And it's really being willing to stay with the direct experience and at the same time be able to see thoughts as thoughts and beliefs as beliefs without kind of following them wherever they go. Because otherwise what happens is, what was happening for me at the time, is that the thoughts would trigger tension, tightness, contraction in the body, heart beating really fast, and that would create more thoughts. And then it kind of escalated in that way. What's key is to untangle these different parts of our experience. And the Buddha talked about that, you know, 2,500 years ago. He said, in the seen, let there just be the seen. In the heard, just the heard. So rather than letting one experience trigger another and then re-trigger something else and get caught up in this kind of ball of wax, to be able to untangle them, stay with the sensations, ride the waves of the experience, see the thoughts as thoughts. So this was a very helpful entry point, not an easy one, but a very helpful entry point. And I talk about it in a couple of the chapters of the book, of working with the thoughts and working with the bodily sensations. But I want to just come back now to kind of something, share some reflections about why habits, and this was a habit, it was a habit of stressful thinking. It was a pattern that I had created over time through repetition. And then it would get triggered by, you know, particular conditions. It would get activated again and again. So I want to look at what habits are and how they form and why they're so hard to change. And I'm going to put it very simply. It's not going to make it, you know, more complex than it needs to be. But habits develop when we repeat a behavior, or it could also be a pattern of thinking, often enough under consistent conditions. So just take a simple example. Maybe Janet would like this one. You know, you might be sitting at home and you might be feeling sad or anxious or lonely or on your own at the end of the evening. And then you feel, oh, I'm kind of not feeling too good. Oh, you know what would be nice? I've got some Haagen-Dazs. I've got some Cherry Garcia in the freezer. Oh, I love make me feel better. So I go get a nice big bowl and have some. Oh, yeah, I do feel better now after having that, you know. So, okay, that's just a one-time thing. But you do that the next night. You know, a little bit more likely to because you've done it. You know, there's a kind of a little patterning in the back. Oh, yeah, that, I remember yesterday. That felt quite nice, didn't it? You know, so the same feeling. Oh, yeah, I got that feeling again. So off, you know, go again. Now, after a while, there's no scientific agreement on how many days or how many times, because we're all different. We're all wired differently, etc. But normally, it's some number of times we'll do it. What actually happens is that behavior gets assigned to a fast-acting brain process. It gets assigned to some, you know, a part of the brain that makes it go, you know, operate more quickly than if we were to think each time Oh, now I'm going to... Now, shall I have the ice cream or shall I not have the ice cream? As long as we're in that mode, we're in a kind of more in the prefrontal cortex. We're in the, you know, thinking, rational mode. But once it's moved into thought, it bypasses, essentially bypasses the prefrontal cortex, the more advanced part of the brain, and it just gets activated by, you know, the situation, the context. It might be just being in that place, having that feeling, lonely, sad. And then, you know, it happens, and it happens automatically. It becomes a habit in that way. And as we know, habits can be both helpful and unhelpful, healthy and unhealthy. I tend not to use the words good and bad because that kind of labels them. But if you wanted to, you could say, you know, bad, good and bad habits. And the brain doesn't have any hierarchy. You know, this habitual part of the brain doesn't distinguish between healthy and unhealthy. It's kind of much more, reptilian. It's like, do I get the reward? Oh, if it's heroin, okay. If it's exercise, okay. It's not like exercise is better. That's more the prefrontal cortex is saying, oh yeah, heroin, if I do, yeah, that's going to lead to unhealthy things. Exercise, that's more healthy. So, but this habitual part of the brain doesn't make those distinctions. And so we can just as easily get caught up in unhealthy habits as with healthy ones. So they become automatic, they become unconscious. There's a wonderful way it was put, you may be familiar with this, by Donald Hebb about 60 years ago, the Canadian psychologist, who said, neurons that fire together, wire together. Neurons that fire together, wire together. I mean, that's what's happening. The neurons firing with that feeling, the lonely feeling, the feeling, oh, the reward I get for that, feeling a nice feeling, a warm feeling from the cold ice cream. And so do that often enough, the firing becomes wiring, you know, and it becomes like, and it becomes, it's like it becomes a, you know, a train, you know, shunted down a fast track, you know, fast tracked. It's like whoosh, psh, then it goes there, bypassing our intentions. So neurons firing together, then wiring together. And then these, you know, the habit gets triggered by the environment, time of day, persons we're with, people we're with, the feelings, the emotions, the place. And then we go, once it's been established, then it gets activated by these triggers or by these situational things. So when we're in that situation where we're triggered to carry out a habit, particularly an unhealthy habit, the way it, kind of the image I have is here's our prefrontal cortex, which is very, very helpful to us. It's what helps us make choices and decisions about what matters. The reflection on intention was very much using the prefrontal cortex. It was kind of, you know, what matters most to me, what gets in the way, etc. But it's not the fastest acting part of the brain, you know. And so when the habit comes into conflict with even with an intention, I want to do this, then the habit will tend to win out. It's like the way I think about it is like a race between a Ferrari and a Model T Ford, or a, you know, whatever your, you know, a bicycle if you prefer. You know, the Ferrari is going to be at the finish line before the other has hardly, you know, basically has left the starting line. So this is what we're dealing with habits. It's something that if you want to know a little bit about the science of it, Charles Duhigg, who wrote The Power of Habit, a great book on habit and how they form, doesn't really deal with mindfulness, though. That's why I felt I had something I still had, you know, wanted to say about this. But he said, he speaks about how habits are the brain's way of conserving energy, allowing our minds to ramp down more often, and he points to the evolutionary benefits of habits. It's quite a nice little paragraph. He says, an efficient brain requires less room, which makes for a smaller head. You never thought of that, would you? A smaller head, which makes childbirth easier and therefore causes fewer infant and mother deaths. So, you know, I mean, imagine if you had to think every time you drove a car, you had to really think about every step of the way. You probably need to have a brain the size of an elephant's, you know. And how do you give birth to these big-headed? Anyway, we won't even go there too. And he goes on to say, an efficient brain also allows us to stop thinking constantly about basic behaviors, such as walking and choosing what to eat. So we can devote mental energy to inventing spears, irrigation systems, and eventually airplanes and video games. The apex of human civilization, the video game. There's a reason why we have these habits, and they work for us a lot of the time, but in certain situations, they don't, when we get caught up in patterns, which in the beginning may have had, you know, I want to do this, I want to be comforted because, you know, maybe as a child you didn't feel you were getting enough love from your caregivers, and you compensated by eating, you know, eating a lot or eating sweets. And then that becomes a pattern. Now, that was functional at the time, but over a long period of time, I mean, it was helpful in that situation. But if that's what drives you throughout your life, it's not going to be so helpful. So how do we address these habits? How do we change patterns that have become established that don't serve us? I just want to say something that the Buddha knew about this very clearly 2,500 years ago, and he put it in a sentence that come down to us in this English form. He said, whatever you frequently think about and ponder on, this becomes the inclination of your mind. What you frequently think about and ponder on, this becomes the inclination of your mind. So, in other words, if you keep thinking angry thoughts, oh, these people are always so mean to me, or why nothing ever works out for me, the world is so unfair. You know, we create these thoughts in the mind. Then what our mind over time is going to be filled with is angry thoughts. You know, we're going to become, over time, we'll become an angry person. Not because that's essentially who we are, but that's how we've trained ourselves. We're cultivating that, those qualities of mind, which actually don't serve us, but, you know, in some sense we're thinking they do. We're thinking that will be helpful to us. Conversely, if we cultivate kindness, compassion, forgiveness, loving kindness, then those are the qualities that are going to fill our mind. This is what the Buddha was talking about. It has there's a word for it that you may be familiar with. It's karma. You know, and karma, even though it's widely misunderstood, really just means we reap what we sow. You know, we sow kind thoughts, then what our mind is going to be filled with is kindness. If we act kindly, we will strengthen that capacity of kindness in our mind and in our heart. Conversely, with anger and fear and greed, we see a lot of it around us in our culture right now. What is it that's being fueled in certain areas of our culture? So we reap what we sow. There's another wise axiom that goes, you might have heard of this, it's sow a thought, reap an act. Sow an act, reap a habit. Sow a habit, reap a character. Sow a character, reap a destiny. So it's like from the thought to the act, to the habit, to the character, to the destiny. It's not, again, it's not because this is essentially who we are. If we cultivate fear or anger within ourselves, it's not that we're an angry person, you know, in some essential way, but that's what we're choosing to cultivate. That's what we're choosing to put our attention and to put our energy. So the question then becomes, what do we choose to cultivate? What qualities of heart and mind do we choose to cultivate? And what do we choose to let go of, abandon? You know, when angry thoughts come into our minds, to say, oh, this is anger, rather than, you know, believing that thought and that we should act upon it. Thought, act, habit, character, destiny. So one of the things, as I thought about and reflected on habits, was What it did for me was to increase my compassion, to see that this is not so much, you know, me being bad or me failing or you being bad or failing, but more just these tendencies of the mind, that the brain really, that has evolved through evolution. And so all of us can make unhealthy choices. And once we repeat them often enough, they become compounded. They remain largely unexamined. And we just keep going with them. And it's kind of becomes who we are. Not that we can't change it, but if we don't bring it into awareness, it is, we become what we do. As somebody said, we become what we frequently do. We become what we frequently do. So how do we address habits? Now, there's a lot of great books out there on habits. But one thing that there hasn't been a whole lot of, and which inspired me to kind of write and reflect in this area, is there hasn't been a lot of writing on bringing awareness to habits, in the sense of bringing mindfulness to habits. A lot of books out there on habits, really good books, a lot of great books out there on mindfulness, but as of yet, not a lot on bringing mindfulness to changing habits. So where does mindfulness come in this process of changing these habits that have developed over time? How does mindfulness help us change habits? I'd put it simply this way. If habits are the way our brain makes behaviors simple and more efficient by making them automatic and instinctual rather than intentional, then the antidote to this automatic and habitual, you know, tendency of the mind or process of the mind is to bring these patterns and habits into the light of awareness. Mindfulness, I think, is the essential antidote to habits or unhealthy habits, because it brings what is unconscious and automatic into awareness, where we can make choices rather than acting out old patterns. Mindfulness makes what is invisible, unconscious, visible and conscious. It takes something that has moved out of the realm of conscious choice back into the realm of conscious choice. So I think Viktor Frankl, the great psychologist who wrote Man's Search for Meaning, put it this way, and I think wonderfully, clearly this way. He said, between the stimulus and the response is a space. In that space lies our ability to choose. And in our ability to choose lies our freedom. So between stimulus and response is a space. In that space lies our ability to choose. And in our ability to choose lies our freedom. So really this is saying exactly the same as what the Buddha's teachings are saying. That if we can bring awareness into that space between stimulus and response. And what's happening with habits is there isn't a space between stimulus and response. We're going straight from stimulus to response. We're getting fast-tracked down, you know, the trigger, and we're off. We're already eating the ice cream. What happened there? I didn't remember going to the freezer, you know, the kind of the way, but that's really what's happening. If we can pause and create that space, then that's the space where we can make choice. And in that space of choice, we could go down the old pathway that isn't helpful to us, but we also have the choice of going down another pathway or not going down any pathway at all. And one thing we can do is, rather than acting out the pattern, we can just stay with the direct experience. What am I feeling now? How would it be to stay with this rather than getting the cookie or screaming at the person or sending the angry email or, you know, getting caught up in road rage or whatever it is? how about if I stay with that direct experience and see, as I was saying before, how it's impermanent, how it comes and stays for a while and then passes? This is what mindfulness allows us to do. But without mindfulness, we don't really have the space to do that. You know, we have to bring the pattern into awareness. And that's the key element of mindfulness. So this is what I talk about in the book, and I highlight a number of ways in which mindfulness can help us find a new pathway, a more healthy, a more beneficial pathway, rather than going down the unhealthy pathways. And similarly, how it can help us create new, more healthy habits, not just abandoning unhealthy ones. And the first way we can do this is through bringing awareness to our intentions. And that's what we did in that guided reflection. Kind of bring into awareness, what is it that I care about? What is it I care about most deeply? What's my deepest aspiration? That intention will direct us towards what we care about. It will align our actions with our deepest intentions. And that's what we want to do. If we're going to be happy, if we're going to be truly peaceful and free, our actions have to be in alignment with what we care about most deeply. If there's a contradiction between that, there's going to be some suffering involved. If you're not walking your talk, you know, there's going to be some stress. There's going to be contraction. You know, we're going to know that we're not being true to ourselves. So being clear about what our intentions are is essential. As Yogi Berra put it, if you don't know where you're going, you'll end up someplace else. So we don't want to end up someplace else. We want to end up where we're going. So we want to know where we're going. We want to be clear about our intentions. We also want to be clear about what gets in the way, what is out of alignment. And that's what I was inviting us to kind of bring into the field of awareness. Is there something? You know, and for me, in writing the book, it was like I could really shine the spotlight on things that I just wasn't really conscious of. You know, at the times when I would be impatient in driving, you know, I kind of, it was like I was in some story that I had somewhere to get to, everybody else was in the way, you know, and I could get caught up in that story until I brought awareness to it. I said, oh, what am I really wanting here? What's my deepest intention? And then I could connect with, well, I want to get to where I'm going, but I also want everybody else to get where they're going, and I want everybody to be safe. Okay, then my actions are not really living that out. So I have to, if I come into how I'm doing that, let me come back to my experience and come back to the present moment. Okay, noticing I'm leaning into the future. Okay, come back, breathe into it. And over a period of, you know, a number of few weeks, I was able to make a shift there because that was coming from lack of awareness. There were things in my life were triggering some story in my mind. And when I'd get in the car, the story tended to be one of a person wanting to get somewhere. You know, Tara talks about this, you know, it's kind of like in my spacesuit, you know, wanting to get somewhere, in my car trying to get somewhere. No, and a number of other areas to the value and the power of bringing awareness to what is outside the field of awareness. I talk a little bit in the book about a period, this is going back maybe 15 years or so, but how this might be something familiar to some of you as well, but how, you know, at the end of a work day, I worked in an office, you know, an NGO at the time, you know, at the end of every day, I'd go home and I'd have a couple of glasses of wine, you know, and it wasn't a big deal. I wouldn't have two bottles of wine. I'd have a couple of glasses of wine. And I'd, you know, it wasn't like costing me more than I could afford. And in most ways, it wasn't a big deal. But I noticed something that felt like there's something doesn't feel right. I'd kind of like, before I'd get home, do I have a bottle of wine at home? You know, it was a kind of sense of I needed it. And I noticed there was this leaning into it. So it was really helpful just to bring that into the light of awareness. It wasn't like I was, you know, getting drunk every night, but it was just something that I was leaning into. And any time we lean into something in a contracted way, even if it's not addiction, you know, but just something much, you know, not that far along the path. But if there is that contraction, there's going to be suffering. So mindfulness allows us to kind of bring this into anything that gets in the way of being truly at peace, truly happy, into the light of awareness, so we can make choices. So intention is being very clear about our intentions and making a commitment to change. And, you know, there are very simple and valuable steps we can take to, if we do make a commitment, I'm going to make a change in this area, of kind of noting it and checking it off every day and looking at things that might be an obstacle to carrying out a healthy new habit or abandoning an old habit. Lots of helpful things we can do. But the main thing is knowing what we care about most deeply, being aware of what's in the way, and making a commitment to change. So that's the first thing. The second is the power of attention. When we practice meditation, as we did tonight, and as many of you do at home and in your own life, one of the things we're doing is we're training our mind to be present. We're focusing our attention. We're gathering our attention. We might use the breath to do that, you know, focusing the attention. And then coming back when the mind moves into thought, as we did in the meditation. Not to make a problem out of thinking, making, you know, oh, I shouldn't be thinking. But just noticing and coming back with kindness, with acceptance. So when we do that, we strengthen this muscle of attention. And bringing this muscle of attention to habit patterns is profoundly valuable. It can help us bring awareness to habits before they happen, when they're happening, and after they've happened. So we can bring awareness if there's something like, if you want to, you know, in the example I gave of eating ice cream every night. Well, one thing you might do if you thought about that is like, well, you know, if I wanted not to eat ice cream every night, wouldn't it be a good idea if rather than having ice cream in the freezer, I had nuts and bananas or apples, you know, that I would, if I did feel that sense of, you know, some uncomfortable feeling, I could have a more healthy response to it rather than just going down that pathway. So that would be bringing awareness to the pattern before it happens. It's crucial, too, to bring awareness to the pattern, the habit, when it's happening. You know, and I think of this, the image that I like a lot is of riding the waves. You know, feeling the urge, feeling the stimulus, feeling the tightness or the tension, feeling the heart beating really fast, you know, if you're feeling anxious or stressed. And to just stay with that experience. I think of it as riding the waves, thinking of being on a surfboard and how a big wave comes along. And, you know, and you kind of ride that wave, and then it comes down, and then it's a smaller wave. So just opening to everything that's arising and meeting it with kindness. So riding the waves of our experience. Developing the skills to do that. And that's a way of transforming habit patterns, by staying with the experience rather than, you know, going to some, you know, some way of covering it over or avoiding it or pushing it away or resisting it. So that's the during. And then the after, it's really important that when we want to change a pattern and then maybe we don't succeed, you know, we do go to the, you know, to the freezer for the ice cream, that we meet that experience with kindness, with acceptance, with compassion. Because if we don't, we're going to kind of be making ourselves into a bad person. Oh, there I go again. I can't do this. Oh, I'm never going to be able to do this. I'm worthless, you know. So meeting our experience with kindness, with compassion, but still with intention. I'm saying, okay, I did it this time. Let me begin again. And that's the wonderful thing with mindfulness. One of the most powerful things about mindfulness is that we can always begin again. We can come back to this moment, say, okay, whatever happened before, I can come back and I can begin again. So that muscle of attention, of gathering attention, can be tremendously helpful in transforming habits. The third is the attitude. or attitudes that we bring to our experience, which is really key. It's really key in the practice of mindfulness, and it's the key to transforming, changing habits. That is to meet our experience with kindness, and I talked about this in the meditation, with kindness, with acceptance, with curiosity. These are the three qualities that, for me, I think are really indispensable, essential qualities of heart and mind that we bring to this practice. Radical acceptance, you know, deep-rooted acceptance, not conditional, oh, I'll stay with this as long as it's gone in 5 minutes, you know, but rather deep-rooted acceptance, this, I be with this as it is. Acceptance, kindness that gives that heart quality to the experience, allows us to be with it. Could be as simple as, you know, that you're putting your hand on your heart and just saying, you know, I care about this suffering, or may I be happy. You know, just that kindness. And then the curiosity. The curiosity that that really transforms our experience if we bring interest to it. Henry Miller, the writer, said, "The moment one gives close attention to anything, even a blade of grass, it becomes a mysterious, awesome, indescribably magnificent world in itself." So anything we bring curiosity to, interest to, is transformed. Even boredom. We bring interest to boredom, it's no longer boredom. It's curiosity about this thing that we call boredom. So it's curiosity. So that's a key attitude, these cultivating these attitudes. And then just to say in three sentences, some other qualities that we bring to habits, the qualities of mindfulness, are, as I said, riding the waves of our experience. Another is to explore deep-rooted beliefs, to really get below, you know, what am I believing about this situation or this experience or myself or my life that's helping to drive this pattern? You know, it might be an underlying belief that, you know, I'm not good enough or I'm not worthy or nothing's going to work out for me, so I comfort myself in some way or I avoid certain kinds of experience. So through mindfulness, we can bring awareness to these deep-seated beliefs. And Tara, in her book True Refuge, has a wonderful chapter of bringing rain, recognize, allow, investigate, and not identify or nourish with compassion, in the newer version, to these deep-seated beliefs. And this is a powerful way of transforming habits by going to what's really deeply underneath them all. And then finally, meeting our experience with self-compassion and with loving kindness, cultivating the qualities of heart and mind that are going to help us open to our experience fully and make choices that do align with our deepest intentions and how we want to live our lives. So I was going to finish with a reflection on the current period that we're living through, but I'll just say it in a sentence or two, and that is that we're experiencing a time where people are acting out a lot of habits in the world, a lot of habits of fear, a lot of habits of anger, where they, and to an extent we, are not opening fully to our experience. There's Albert Camus said, "We all carry within us our places of exile, our crimes, our ravages. Our task is not to unleash them on the world, but it is to transform them in ourselves and in others." And that's really the practice of mindfulness, of transforming our fears and our anger into love and into compassion, rather than what we see a lot of right now, blaming it on others, fueling fears, and saying those people are the problem. If only we dealt with them, then everything would be okay. And it's an illusion. It's a delusion. The only way we find freedom is coming back and being willing to be with our experience as it is. So if you want to explore this more, I've got a 6-week class on bringing mindfulness to habits where we do kind of explore each of these areas over a 6-week period. And also, the book is available. I'll be around for a while if anyone would like to have a book signed. And just want to finish off by thanking you for your kind attention. I hope this has been helpful to you. Like, maybe leaving here, you might think about, You know, are there is there something that would merit attention in my life and in this time and to explore this? And so thank you, and deep gratitude for your practice and your life, and namaste.